the term pay attention is a really important one because it implies an opportunity cost in the language of economics. It's a scarce resource. You pay attention. I'm paying attention to you, which means I'm not paying attention to a whole range of other stimuli that I could be paying attention to. So that's the production function of happiness, again, in the language of economics. Like, so you can get more happiness as you can get more widgets by having more inputs, right? You can get more money in, or you can get more, you know, time or whatever, friends or family, all these things, as you can get more land, labour and capital to produce widgets. But you need an efficient production process. So very well having all the land and labour and capital in the world, or having all the money in the world, all the friends in the world, if you're not paying attention to them in ways that will produce widgets on one hand and happiness on the other, what's the point?
From PHI Media, I'm Gordon Thane, and this is Designing Happier Lives, episode 212, The Determinants of Happiness.
You're listening to the Public Health Insight podcast, your go-to space for all things public health and global health, from the Sustainable Development Goals to the social determinants of health, as well as interesting dialogues about the diverse career opportunities that exist in these fields. Remember to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so other people like you can benefit from our content.
All right, so in the last episode, we started our chat with Dr. Dolan, who is a professor of behavioral sciences at the London School of Economics. He studies the relationship between human behavior and happiness. If you missed it, he talked about how he got into the field of health economics, why it's important not to underestimate the power of luck, and the difficulty he faced getting the science across as a host of a popular TV show in the UK. This time, in Chapter 2, the conversation continues with identifying the determinants of happiness, why it's so challenging to measure it, finding out if the midlife crisis is real or not, the opportunity costs of attention, exploring the connection between money and happiness, and understanding social narratives and expectations. It's a lot. Yep, seriously, it's a lot. It's a bit much. So we start off with the basics by starting off small. When we say happiness, let's make sure we're talking about the same thing. So happiness can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but in the context of the work that you do and how you speak about happiness, what is it? How would you define that? Is there a standard definition, or there needs to be several definitions of happiness?
Yeah, I think we need some conceptual clarity.
Yes.
So I think it's really important. I think this ties into, I just make it general for a minute, or a little more broad, and then come narrow. So often, you know, when we talk about mental health, mental illness, happiness, well-being, we've got a whole range of different ways that we talk about those things. And I think it's really important, and this is where I go back to my economics, I suppose, to sort of think in these terms of, you have a left-hand side of a regression equation variable, the thing that you're trying to explain or determine or measure, that's the outcome. And then you have a lot of right-hand side variables, all the determinants of the important left-hand side variable, right? So all the things that affect the quantity that you're interested in. And there's enormous amount of category confusion between left and right-hand side variables. And for different purposes, you're going to have a different variable on the left-hand side and different variables on the right-hand side. So be clear about the purpose to which the measures are going to be put. And then we can maybe start, you know, breaking our way through that mess to get some clarity. And I say that in relation to, so like, for example, people would say, like, well, social contact is happiness, and you know, mental health is happiness and stuff. Yeah, these are really important determinants. They have really significant effects, and they're right hand side variables. The quantity that I'm interested in on the left hand side is how you feel, and I can measure that in all sorts of ways. I'd ideally like to find out without asking you. That would be the best. I mean, and as we move through technology, and this is where, you know, social media can be a force for good, or AI or whatever can help us maybe find out how happy you are without never having to ask you a question. Because it's the moment you ask people a question, they have to stop whatever it is they're doing and answer you. So you get a reactivity effect. So there's problems in the self-report. So whether it's self-report or some other means through which I can assess it, it's how you feel. Happiness is in a feeling. And those feelings coming two guises. And again, sorry, to emphasize this right-hand side variable. So all these things that you might have, anxiety, depression, addiction problems or lots of sex or whatever it is, right? All those things, you know, on the right hand side, good and bad, will all be determinants of a feeling.
As the conversation unfolds, we learn about an intricate balance between pleasure and purpose in defining happiness, meaningful experiences, and for a truly happy life. But as we get closer to honing in on what happiness is, there's still a lingering question. The difference between being content and being happy, and other related feelings intertwine within that. Well, we have an audience member who actually wants this cleared up as well.
And those feelings then come in two guises. They come in feelings of what people would typically think of happiness, I guess, hedonic feelings. So positive ones and high arousal, like, you know, joy. Positive ones and low arousal, like contentment. And then negative ones of high arousal, like anxiety and stress. And negative ones of low arousal, like sadness. And that's one set of feelings. But alongside those set, another really important category of feelings, which loosely I call purpose, to sit alongside pleasure. So these are adjectives that would describe how meaningful, how worthwhile, how futile and pointless activities, experiences, thoughts are. And I make a case in Happiness by Design that happy lives are ones that contain a balance between pleasure and purpose. Not the same, not equal, not the same for any two individuals. It's for you to work out what that optimal balance is. But a happy life is one that contains things that feel pleasurable and purposeful, and the absence of things that feel, you know, painful in an experiential sense, but also feel like they might be a waste of time or futile or pointless. That's happiness, and that's how I'm very clear in defining it. And all of the other things that we can discuss will all contribute to those sentiments or feelings of pleasure and purpose in big and small ways.
Just so I understand it too, and we do have a question from the audience that I can get into, which further maybe delineates what's happiness in terms of how we speak about it and what's not. We had a question from Adrian in Toronto, who was excited when we were going to be speaking to you. And the questions that they were asking is the difference between contentment and happy. So is contentment something you also feel like happiness, or is it exists somewhere else?
Yeah, so there's a circumplex of emotion, and I kind of very quickly went through that in the four quadrants, right? So you basically got you've got arousal and you've got valence. And so contentment is a positive valence, low arousal feeling, in contrast to joy, which would be a high arousal, positive valence, or in contrast to sadness, which would be low arousal but low valence, you see. So you can start locating any adjective that you give as a hedonic word can go into the circumplex. But things like, you know, how meaningful, like I think we're having a lot of fun today, but it also feels like there's a point to it, right? It also feels purposeful. It feels like this is an experience that has both pleasure and purpose contained within it. And since a significant motivator of the human condition is to feel like we're doing things that are worthwhile, I think it's important that we capture those in our experiential measures. And very much in contrast to whether my life feels meaningful, all right, you know, does my identity as a dad, you know, or as a professor, you know, or as a West Ham fan or whatever, does that feel like it's meaningful or purposeful? It's actually in the experiences of being a professor, being a dad, being a West Ham fan at the games. That's where you feel those twin sets of experience, the pleasure, you know, or pain on the one hand, and the purpose or pointlessness on the other.
Much like money, time is a scarce resource. And like money, you can pay time in the form of attention. In this way, when you're paying attention to something, it inevitably comes at a cost of focusing on something else. What you pay attention to, intentionally or unintentionally, directly impacts your likelihood of being happy. It's a concept best described as the opportunity cost of paying attention. You mentioned at the top too, people mean different things when they say mental health, happiness, and contentment, and on all these things. what do we get wrong about happiness in our understanding of it as individuals in terms of what we think it is and the actions that we take to get there that's kind of problematic right now?
Yeah, it's a really good question because if we get the definitional issues resolved, then we can start directing our answer, like we can answer those questions more accurately, more robustly, and we can find sources of contention as well, by the way. I mean, that's also helpful. When you locate happiness in a feeling, in an experience, there are, well, two obvious things about that is that you're happier when you feel better for longer. So there's an intensity component, but there's also a duration component. That's really significant. So your happiness would then be approximated by some area under a curve, right? You know, so you'd have moment, you know, all the times that you're feeling particular degrees of intensity, you know, pleasure and purpose, and multiplied by the duration of them. So your happiness is increased when you can increase the intensity and when you can make those feelings last longer. And that might give you guidance into different ways in which individuals or policymakers might intervene. One thing that's been interesting on the duration dimension is I've been struck by how time is the scarcest resource that we have, right? We're having a great time. It's pleasurable, purposeful, but we're another, you know, whatever, now 40-odd minutes closer to death than we were when we started. And we're not getting that time back, right? It's not like we can beg, borrow and steal it like we can money. So it's incumbent on us to think about how we can use that to best effect. And it's really struck me that policymakers don't often think in those terms. They will think about the intensity measure, you know, like and also the conditions and circumstances of people's lives. But how you can nudge or shove people to reallocate time in ways that make it easier for them to be happier, it's not really central. I'm sure in your experiences, I can see you both nodding. I think that's probably resonant around the world, actually. Time is the scarcest resource, and yet it's the one that we spend least time thinking about how we can best allocate it. So I think that's an important insight. So much of happiness will then be about how we use our time. You know, feeling good and bad, doing the things that we do with the people that we either enjoy or not enjoy doing them with. And when our mind wanders in places where it's not located in the activity or with the people. And that is all bound up in the word attention. Mm. That is literally, we are what we attend to. The term pay attention is a really important one because it implies an opportunity cost in the language of economics. It's a scarce resource. You pay attention. I'm paying attention to you, which means I'm not paying attention to a whole range of other stimuli that I could be paying attention to. So that's the production function of happiness, again, in the language of economics. Like, so you can get more happiness as you can get more widgets by having more inputs, right? You can get more money in, or you can get more, you know, time or whatever, friends or family, all these things, as you can get more land, labor, and capital to produce widgets. But you need an efficient production process. So very well having all the land and labor and capital in the world, or having all the money in the world, all the friends in the world, if you're not paying attention to them in ways that will produce widgets on one hand and happiness on the other, what's the point? Mm-hmm. So my attention has been focused on that attention production process, and that's critical. That's where we allocate our resources, our attention, in ways that make us happy or not. And the really simple, basic and obvious insight from that is that if you want to be happier, pay attention to things that make you feel good, right? I mean, like, so much about actually science and life, it's not just academic research and happiness, is obvious but overlooked. Obvious but overlooked. That's like one of the terms that I use most often now, because a lot of things I say to people about being happier, right? Go outdoors, listen to music, spend time with people you like being with. You don't need a professor at LSE to tell you that. Well, I say, well, okay, then, well, why aren't you doing it then? So why aren't you doing more of those things? If it's so obvious,
right.
Why are you never listening to music? Why are you hardly ever spending time with people that you like being with? Why don't you ever go outdoors, right? It's like, if it's so obvious.
So happiness is this subjective experience that we feel, and it is determined by purpose and pleasure, amongst other factors. In science, though, we like to try to measure everything. We can measure the rates of diseases like tuberculosis, cancer, and mental health diagnoses. But is there a way to know how many people are feeling happy in any given moment? Well, you could just ask people how happy they feel and see what their responses are. but measuring it in reality in a meaningful way. Turns out that it's not that simple.
Now, one of the things I thought about too in some of my conversations with people, because we kind of talk about this a lot of times, is like, one, you mentioned that there is a measure for happiness. Some people wonder kind of how do you go about measuring that? What does that look like? But then you do. Is there anything you could tell us about what the data tells us about who's happy, who's not? Are there differences between different types of people, personality traits, different countries, income, like paint a picture for us on who's happy, who's not, and the in-between, what's going on there?
Okay, nice. So that's why it was important that we had this discussion about the measure, because there is a measure that's much more widely used where I can speak to some of those differences more because there's just more data from many people across many countries over a long time. And some of those are longitudinal data that follow the same people over decades in some cases in some of these data sets. But it's a question that is less close to this measure of feelings that I'm interested in. And it's a question that asks you overall, how satisfied are you with your life these days? Or kind of variants. Like the wording varies across surveys, and the scale that people are asked to answer them on varies. But it's broadly, you know, scale of 1 to 10 or 0 to 10. How satisfied are you with your life these days? Now, that's a useful question, and it will give us some useful insights. But it's not really a question about happiness as I described it earlier. And the other thing about that question is that if you think about that question, if I asked you overall how satisfied are you with your life these days on a scale of 0 to 10, that's a difficult question. And it's probably going to take you a little while to answer it. But people answer these questions in about 2 seconds. So one of the insights from psychology is that if we've got questions, they've got answers. But the answers are nearly always not to the question that we're asking. People will always find an easier question to answer than the one that we're asking, right? So how satisfied am I in my life these days? Well, I don't know. I mean, what do I do? Do I reflect on all the things that go on in my life and then try and form a judgment about how well that's going compared to myself, other people, expectations, whatever? Or do I just think I'm about an 8 out of 10? I'm about an 8 out of 10. That feels like a good question to answer. I have no idea what that really means, but I give you an answer to it. So we can get some signal that comes through the noise of the answers to these questions, because people who think of themselves as being about an 8, you know, it turns out, do have better conditions, the right-hand side variables, in their lives than the people who say a 4 or 5 or a 6. But whether that gives us anything substantive, really, really to say about the policy implications that you might draw from it, well, that's a longer question to answer, and I'm a bit more skeptical about the answer that I would give to that.
Time to bust a myth that you hear over and over again. Do people generally get happier with age, or is it the opposite? It seems like people are the most satisfied with their life towards the beginning and towards the end of their lives, mirroring this sort of a U-shaped curve, which would indicate that a midlife crisis is actually a real thing.
Having said all of that, the most important thing that life satisfaction show us, which is the main thing that they show us across all data sets around the world, is a U-shape in age. So you are least happy when you're about 50. So I'm actually quite nice. It's actually quite good now. I'm 55 now, so I'm on the uptick bit. And one of the nice things about teaching LSE, because all these, you know, students are a lot younger than me, it's like a Peter Pan world where you get older every year and they all stay the same age, is the fact that they're on the downward bit of the happiness function. Mm-hmm. They're going to get miserable every passing year for the next 20 or whatever, whereas I'm on the upward bit where I'm going to get happier every year for the next 20 years. And that's a robust finding, and it's found in primates, right? So when zookeepers are rating the happiness of monkeys, not the monkeys themselves, that would be a difficult question, but when the zookeepers are rating them, the monkeys have a midlife crisis. So that midlife crisis in life satisfaction is a very real phenomenon. It's across all genders, whether you put controls in, like for income or children or whatever, whether you don't. It's a pretty well-established phenomenon. The midlife crisis is real.
There are widely accepted tools out there to measure how people feel about their lives and what's happening in them. The World Happiness Report by the United Nations presents data that comes from the Gallup World Poll, which measures life satisfaction ratings and emotional well-being. Now, knowing how happy a country is can give some insight on its economic and social development. The issue then becomes asking different people of different languages, of different cultures, to rate their subjective experiences as objective. Dr. Dolan points out the flaws in these tools and the methods that are currently being used to measure happiness.
And what else you can say depends on a lot of things. And as someone who's, I'm more keenly interested in measurement than most economists are. They will often take data as given, run fancy econometric analysis on it, and produce results. But if you've got garbage in, you've got garbage out, right? So I'm much more circumspect about what inferences we can make from these data. So for example, on the international comparisons data, there are some studies showing various things like Scandinavian countries and Latin American countries generally are, you know, happiest regions in the world. East Asia and Southeast Asia are least happy regions. But so much depends on the ways in which those questions are asked in those surveys. The mode of administration matters. I had a paper with a colleague a few years ago where, you know, we showed that being asked how happy you are on the telephone, you know, is very significantly different and higher than if you're asked questions through other means. So okay. one of the ways in which you can improve national happiness is to phone people up and ask them how happy they are. It's about, you know, it's quite a big effect. So I don't know, I can't remember exactly, wow. And I don't misquote me on this, but I think it's about like half the effect of unemployment or something in some of these instances. You know, it's quite, it's big. Because of that reactivity effect, and also, you know, like I don't know how to answer the question, so I look for all sorts of cues and triggers that will help me, and they're heavily affected by the mode of administration. So whilst asking someone is still the best way to find out, if I want to find out, I'm going to ask you, I also need to be alert to some of the very subtle and sometimes not so subtle variables that affect the answer that you give.
I'm imagining too, with different cultures, they might respond differently to different modes of administration.
Correct.
So it kind of gets a bit messy to compare things across the board. Interesting.
Correct. I would say that the things that we would know are obvious but overlooked would be significant determinants of happiness, irrespective of how it's measured. And they would be in relation to your social network, your social capital, your relationships in particular, your friendships. If I was trying to think of a question that would be happiness but wasn't, but like the right-hand side variable that did the heaviest lifting on the left-hand side, I'd ask you something like, and maybe this will resonate with you, I'd ask you something like, do you have someone you can talk to about stuff? That's that very simple question, like, and you say, and you answer yes or no. If your answer to that question is no, you know, the chances are lots of your life is not going very well. You know, so I think that's, again, you know, obvious but overlooked. Having somebody, it doesn't have to be an intimate partner. You don't have to be married or anything, but, you know, like a friend or someone close to you that kind of has your back in some way or another is massive. I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, and it does show up. Those things do show up in some of our happiness data, however it's measured.
Does money make you happy? Or does having money give you one less thing to be unhappy about? Turns out that money does influence the way that you feel, but not for the reasons that you think. I wanted to go back to some of the interactions or intersections between social narratives and happiness, particularly because I think a big one that you're kind of aware of to a certain extent, but you don't really realize how significant of a role it can play. The fact that there's so many people studying it and there's evidence base behind it too. The impact of those social narratives. So just the mere fact of I'm going to work and earn as much money as possible, we don't really immediately see the connection between how detrimental that could be for someone's happiness. What are some of those misconceptions that we have as individuals about the things that we put our energy in that we think will make us happy, but in reality, it doesn't really do the trick?
Yeah. So let me close off the earlier piece by just emphasizing that happiness is found in the things that we do and the people that we do them with, right? So it's in the small stuff. There's a book in the 80s saying, don't sweat the small stuff absolutely wrong in terms of happiness. It's in the small stuff. It's sweat the small stuff. Sweat how much music you spend your time listening to. Sweat how much time you spend hanging out with your friends. You know, go outdoors, laugh, help other people, have new experiences. Now, money will be helpful for many of those things. Poverty makes people miserable. Poverty is very attention seeking, right? We're going back to the production function of happiness. You're paying attention to money. How are you going to feed the kids? How are you going to pay the bills? That makes people miserable. So I do sometimes think that there's a sort of glibness sometimes when academics or whoever say money, you know, doesn't make you happy. That's normally coming from people who have enough money to not be miserable and not to worry about feeding their kids and paying the bills. So very important that we emphasize that, or that I emphasize that. But then you get enough money and you stop paying attention to it. And then maybe when you get loads of money, you start paying attention again. Like, have I got the right investments? Have I got the right portfolio? Am I investing in the right stocks? Should we buy another property? Like, all those things that then become attention seeking again. And I think you mentioned, we sort of mentioned football in passing earlier, or soccer, as some people might, as some wrong people might call it.
Yeah, that's what we say in Canada. It's,
exactly. I knew that. So sometimes pundits after a game, or managers or whatever, will say that the refs had a good game. And that's nearly always because they have gone unnoticed and not made any controversial decisions or whatever, right? They've let the game flow. And I think that's what income is in your life. Income's like a good referee. It lets the game flow. But you're not paying attention to it. So you're not paying attention to it because you've got too little or too much. So for some of these things, there might be a sweet spot. There might be. I mean, it's, you know, it's still better to have more than less. But the question then is the opportunity costs, or the what you're giving up in order to get more. So if you are spending less time with people that you like being with, if you are spending less time outdoors, if you are spending less time listening to music, if you are spending less time laughing or having new experiences, then earning more money isn't going to make you happier. And it wouldn't be surprising if it didn't either.
So as one would have it, money is one thing. You can be unhappy with it or without it. As far as the other things, why do we tend to occupy our time with the things that bring us dread and don't spend nearly enough time on the things that bring us joy and happiness? The answer might lie in the social narratives we are told or the ones that we tell ourselves.
I actually told this story in Happiness by Design, which was in many ways a catalyst for Happy Ever After, which is the story, like the storybook one. Of a friend who is my wife's best friend, and we were at dinner, and she was complaining about her job, her boss, her colleagues, everything. She was miserable. It's about like 2 hours of misery she was espousing to us. And then she stood up at the end of dinner, and she wasn't even trying to be funny. And she said, "Oh, of course, I love working what I do." And I was like, but that actually, what she was doing was telling a story on the one hand of a place that she loved when she thought about how it ought to make her happy. The job, the friends being jealous, the parents being proud, somewhere she always wanted to work, in contrast to her experiences day to day, which were, you know, categorically miserable. And I think we have a tendency to pay sometimes too much attention to those narratives and not enough attention to the experiences. And that's really all I've tried to do there, is just draw to it, just to get us to recognize or be noticing them, right? It's not even, doesn't matter if you don't do anything about them even, or if you still feel so story-driven to live in a particular way, then fine, but just a bit of awareness, I guess.
That's so common, though. I giggled when I read, because there was a piece that you have, I think it's in the Independent, where you kind of walk through that example that you just shared about someone who worked for a media company that sounded like they didn't like their job, and at the end of it, "Yeah, but I do love my job." Almost everyone I speak to, that's how the story goes. It's 20 minutes of complaining about it, and then the conclusion is, "Yeah, but I love the job." So it's almost like a story, like you said, telling yourself that because it fits the bill with all these social narratives, I must love it, but you're not really being in tune with your own emotions and feelings about the particular thing.
Exactly, you're being told that it's good.
And you need to feel it.
But we shouldn't be too hard. Like, we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves or other people for that, because it's really hard to swim against the tide of social expectations. So that's why I think for a lot of this, it's a collective action problem. It's not a It's not an individual decision. Like, so if we're on this call and you just told me you've taken a new job, it's like, great. And I'm being paid half of what I was being paid in my last one. We all go like, what? Like, what? That's a bit mad. Like, what are you doing? Like if you tell me you're being paid, if you tell me you're being paid twice as much, we're like, oh, great. You know, so we all buy into this story. We all buy into that narrative. So for you to do something, to take a job that would actually make you happy, is hard work.
Coming up next, the third and final chapter in this three-part miniseries with Dr. Paul Dolan, where we talk about the next steps with all that we've learned about the things that typically make us happy and putting them into action in the way that we live, as well as what governments and society can do to create these conditions for people to be happier in their lives. That's next time on Designing Happier Lives on the Public Health Insight Podcast. This show was edited by me, Gordon Thane, with additional editing from LaShawn Benedict. Sound design and mixing by myself and LaShawn Benedict. The original music from The Music Room, composed by Tom Fox, licensed from Johnny Harris. The cover art design for our show by LaShawn Benedict. The Public Health Insight Podcast is produced by PHI Media. Thank you for listening to the Public Health Insight Podcast, your go-to space for informative conversations, inspiring community action. If you enjoy our podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. See you in the next one.